A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So we've done some episodes about various things related to getting into small electronics, thinking about stuff like our various episodes about how to do ESP32 projects, things of that nature. And I mentioned that I was getting the very basics of a workbench set up. I think it was when I managed to successfully repair my computer, which is one of those things when your computer doesn't boot and you think, there goes something I depend on for work every day. It's a terrible feeling, and being able to actually repair it was pretty great and empowering, and also made me feel that this is a great time to get into that kind of thing, because with the advantage of AI, it's never been more easier, I would say, to take photos. I commonly will just take really good photos of circuit boards on my camera, send it to Gemini, even using live interfaces, and say, okay, this looks like something's broken, how can I fix this? Now, mandatory disclaimer warning, electrocution is a risk. You don't want to go into this kind of thing without knowing you're operating within safe parameters. But for a lot of basic home electronics, where you're working with either no electricity or low volt DC, if you know some basic safety precautions, there's a lot of things that people pay a lot of money for in repair stores, who often might arguably do a worse job than you can do at home. And if you just have basic know-how and a few good tools, and I emphasize a few good tools because it really comes down to just having a good source of lighting, a good precision screwdriver set, some anti-static gear, and the rest of it, to just get started with repairing things or even building things. Now, we've talked about those in isolation, like what are the must-haves? An ESD mat is really handy. What screwdrivers to have on hand, and what little small parts, because that's one thing that I have noticed whenever I'm working on a tech project for something like this, and partially why I set up my inventory system, is you always have everything except that little thing you need. And my solution's been to kind of proactively stock up on the common stuff like M4, M3, M2, screws, and just always have a few of them and know where they are, and then you stop hitting those road bumps. What I'd love to talk about today, Herman and Corin, is a broader question. If you're getting into doing stuff like soldering or even engraving, as we mentioned, for inventory, you're going to be thinking about ventilation. But beyond that, if you're working at a workbench, anyone who's into it, I'm sure, knows what I'm talking about. There's something very pleasant and relaxing and kind of just soulful about it. But I think so much of it depends upon having a place that isn't a cluttered mess of cables, which until recently described my workstation perfectly. I'm thinking about things and tips we can provide that for anyone who's either just getting into hardware tinkering or has been doing this for a while and doing it on a kitchen table when people aren't using it. And even if you have just a small amount of space. Our apartment, as I've mentioned on many episodes, is pretty small, 60 square meters. And I'm kind of improvising a bit. When I'm not using my computer, I'll take out a anti-static mat. But you can still do a lot with what you have. But I think so much of it comes down to actually planning. I get kind of this IKEA paralysis when we go to IKEA, because it's always an expedition and a trip. You're always kind of thinking, oh gosh, what do I need? And it's often hard when you're in those moments to actually think they have all the things that you probably do need to do to make your workstation really nice and pleasant and well set up. But it's hard to kind of think on the moment when you're just looking at these rows of stuff, what would actually be useful. The things that I've seen and I'd love to actually talk about specifically are things like pegboards. Those can be very good, especially for smaller environments, for doing stuff like hanging tools on. And there's a bunch of things I've seen in terms of, you know, the basic tools you might have. Maybe it's a electric screwdriver, a rotary engraver, something for, you know, a head torch, what would you recommend for someone who's for the first time setting up a workstation and you want to just have somewhere that's going to be a joyful and pleasant and focused environment to do this kind of work, that as anyone who's tried to manually fix a slightly twisted or a slightly bent pin on a CPU socket knows, it's incredibly precise. And that can either be, it goes two ways, I found. One, insanely stressful. You're trying to do this on the edge of a couch, and you kind of have no way to succeed. Or you do it in a nicely well-lit, calm, orderly workstation. And often I found that that's actually what makes the difference between success and failure. It's not that there's anything complicated about straightening out a CPU pin with a, so long as you've got some kind of, you know, good lighting, something to magnify it, and a good pair of anti-ESD tweezers, it's pretty straightforward. It's just that doing that in the wrong environment, in the wrong setup, goes from being, it's not just, it makes it harder, it makes it almost impossible. So let's talk about workbench setup for those who want to create something good and enjoyable in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one about workbench setup. And I want to say up front, this isn't just a gear list. The prompt is really asking something deeper. Why does the same repair job feel impossible on a cluttered kitchen table and almost meditative at a properly set up station? And if you're working with limited space, say, a 60 square meter apartment where your workbench is also your desk, is also where you eat, what actually makes the difference between frustration and flow?
This is one of those topics where the barrier to entry is simultaneously real and completely psychological. The tools that transform a workspace aren't expensive, they're just specific, and most people never get told what they are in the right order.
Because you walk into IKEA or browse a hardware catalog and it's just... And the prompt mentions this exact paralysis, translating, I want my workspace to feel good, into, I need this specific SKU, is genuinely hard.
Let's build the workstation from the ground up, in order of what actually changes your experience. And I want to start with the thing nobody starts with.
The least glamorous thing in the room.
The one that determines whether you can work for 40 minutes or 4 hours. Most people buy a workbench or a desk first, then whatever chair fits under it. That's backwards. Your body interfaces with the chair. The chair determines your working height, your posture, whether you're hunching forward to see fine details or sitting back comfortably with a magnifier at eye level.
The chair is the foundation, and everything else stacks on top of it.
For electronics work specifically, you want something different from an office chair. Office chairs are designed for keyboard and monitor height. Electronics work, soldering, inspecting boards, probing test points, happens closer to your face. You're often leaning forward slightly, forearms resting on the bench edge. A chair that's too low and you're craning your neck up. Too high and you're hunched over like a gargoyle.
What's the actual spec to look for?
Adjustable height, obviously, but the key thing is a foot ring. When you're sitting at bench height, typically 36 to 38 inches instead of the standard desk height of 29 to 30, your feet often don't reach the floor comfortably. Dangling feet means you're unconsciously tensing your legs, which leads to lower back fatigue within about 20 minutes. A foot ring gives you a stable reference point. You can get a decent adjustable workshop stool with one for somewhere between $80 and $150. It doesn't need to be a Herman Miller.
What about anti-fatigue mats? I've seen those in workshops.
That's for standing work, and it's worth mentioning because a lot of electronics work benefits from alternating between sitting and standing. Soldering especially, some people prefer to stand for it because you get a better angle on the board. If you're going to stand, a proper anti-fatigue mat isn't optional. Standing on a hard floor while doing fine motor work will destroy your concentration. The mat absorbs micro-movements and keeps blood circulating. You can get a good one for about $30 to $40.
Chair first, then the actual surface, the bench itself.
This is where the space constraint becomes the whole design problem. The prompt mentions 60 square meters. You're not building a dedicated workshop with a massive hardwood bench. You need something that can serve double or triple duty.
Which is actually where the IKEA paralysis mentioned in the prompt becomes a feature, not a bug, if you know what you're looking for.
The secret is that IKEA's kitchen countertops make excellent workbench surfaces. The thicker ones, the Carlby or the Barkabota, are about 1.5 inches thick, solid wood or dense particle board with a wood veneer, and they're designed to handle kitchen abuse. They're substantially more rigid than desktops. For electronics work, you want zero flex. You want a surface that feels like the Earth.
Because when you're trying to seat a stubborn connector, or apply even pressure to a heatsink, any given surface translates directly into uncertainty in your hands.
The kitchen countertop approach has another advantage. You can get them in shorter lengths, like 46 or 50 inches, and pair them with adjustable legs. IKEA's Olov legs let you dial in the exact height. For seated electronics work, set the bench so your elbows are at about 90 degrees with your forearms resting on the surface, typically around 34 to 36 inches.
If you need the bench to also be your regular desk,
then you have two options. Option 1, set it at desk height and accept that you'll be standing for certain electronics tasks. Option 2, and this is the clever one, use a monitor arm and a keyboard tray that can swing out of the way. When you're doing computer work, the keyboard tray is out and the monitor is at eye level. When you need bench space, the keyboard tray slides under and the monitor arm pushes the screen back and up. It takes about 10 seconds to transition.
That's the kind of thing that sounds obvious once you hear it, but most people never think of. They just live with the friction.
Now let's talk about the surface itself. You mentioned an anti-static mat in the prompt, and that's non-negotiable for electronics work. But not all ESD mats are created equal. The ones you want are the two-layer rubber mats, usually blue or green on top with a black conductive layer underneath. They're heat-resistant, which matters for soldering, and they connect to ground through a snap-on wrist strap.
The grounding actually matters? I feel like a lot of people treat ESD mats as superstition.
It matters enormously. Modern integrated circuits have gate oxide layers that are nanometers thick. A static discharge you can't even feel, around 100 volts, is enough to degrade those layers. The chip might not fail immediately. It might fail 6 months later or develop intermittent faults that are a nightmare to diagnose. An ESD mat with a proper ground connection brings the entire work surface and everything on it to the same potential as your body. No potential difference, no discharge. It's physics, not superstition. And an ESD mat costs maybe $30 to $50. A wrist strap is $10. That's cheap insurance against a problem you'll never be able to trace.
You're protecting against the ghost in the machine, the failure that happens later, and you never connect back to the moment you caused it.
That's exactly the phrase I'd use.
Okay, so we've got chair, bench surface, ESD mat. What's next?
And I'm going to be specific because lighting for electronics work is different from general room lighting. You need three things: brightness, color accuracy, and shadow elimination.
Break those down.
Brightness is obvious. You're looking at tiny components, reading minuscule part numbers, inspecting solder joints. The recommended illuminance for detailed electronics work is around 1,000 to 1,500 lux at the work surface. A typical room light gives you maybe 200 to 300 lux, so you need task lighting, and it needs to be bright. Color accuracy, resistor color codes, wire colors, PCB silkscreen markings. If your light source has a low color rendering index, below about 90, CRI, colors shift. A brown resistor band looks red. A violet wire looks blue. You want a CRI of 90 or above, and a color temperature around 4,000 to 5,000 Kelvin, neutral to slightly cool white. Warm white reduces contrast on small details.
Shadow elimination. That's the one people don't think about until their own hand is blocking the light.
A single overhead light creates shadows exactly where you're working. The solution is either a magnifying lamp with a built-in ring light, the ring eliminates shadows by surrounding the work area, or a dual-arm task light positioned from two angles. I personally use a magnifying lamp with a 5-diopter lens and a ring of LEDs around it. The magnifier is critical for inspection work, and the ring light means you're always looking into a shadow-free zone.
The prompt mentioned magnifying things for CPU pin straightening. What magnification are we talking?
For general inspection, a 3-5 diopter magnifying lamp is fine, about 1.75 to 2.25 times magnification. For really fine work, bent pins, solder joint inspection, reading tiny chip markings, you might want a USB microscope or a jeweler's loop at 10 times or higher. But start with the magnifying lamp. It's the workhorse. You can get a decent one for around $60 to $80.
Forward chair, bench surface, ESD mat, lighting. None of this is wildly expensive. We're building a foundation.
That's the point. The foundation costs less than a single repair at a shop. But here's where people go wrong. They jump straight to the exciting tools. The soldering iron, the oscilloscope, the fancy multimeter, and they skip the thing that actually makes those tools usable. Cable management and organization. The prompt says it explicitly, a cluttered mess of cables. That's not just an aesthetic problem. Cable clutter creates two real issues. First, it's a safety hazard. Loose cables catch on things, pull equipment off the bench, create trip risks with soldering irons. Second, visual clutter competes for your attention. When you're trying to trace a signal path or hold a complex schematic in your head, your visual field is full of irrelevant information. It's cognitive load you don't need.
Organization isn't just tidiness. It's literally reducing the processing overhead on your brain while you're working.
The solution is cable routing, not just cable bundling. Underbench cable trays are the best investment here. You mount a metal or plastic tray under the back edge of the bench. All your power strips and power bricks live in it, and cables drop down from the bench surface through grommet holes, run through the tray, and plug in underneath. The bench surface stays clear.
For the cables that have to be on the surface, test leads, USB cables for programming microcontrollers.
Magnetic cable clips. Little silicone or rubber clips with a magnet in the base. You stick them to the edge of a metal bench frame or a magnetic strip, and they hold cables exactly where you want them. When you're not using a cable, it's clipped in place. When you need it, you pull it out, use it, clip it back. The cumulative effect of never having to untangle a cable is enormous.
It's the difference between a 5-second reach and a 30-second wrestling match. Multiply that by 50 times in a work session, and you've lost real concentration.
Now let's talk about the thing that makes all of this feel permanent and intentional, rather than improvised.
The prompt specifically called out pegboards. And I think there's something interesting here. Pegboards have this association with garages and dad workshops, but they're one of the best space-efficient organization systems ever invented.
They're vertical storage, which is the key insight for small spaces. Your bench surface is precious real estate. Every square inch occupied by a tool that's just sitting there is a square inch you can't use for actual work. A pegboard moves tool storage onto the wall, keeps everything visible and reachable, and costs almost nothing. A basic 4-foot by 4-foot pegboard is maybe $30. The hooks and holders are a few dollars each.
There's something psychologically satisfying about a pegboard that a drawer doesn't provide. The tools are displayed. You can see at a glance what's where. It makes the workspace feel like a workspace.
I'd add one thing, outline your tools. Trace around each tool on the pegboard with a marker. It sounds obsessive, but it means you immediately see when something isn't put back, and anyone else who uses your bench knows where things go. It's the visual equivalent of a checklist.
Like a shadow board in a professional workshop. You see the empty outline, and you know something's missing before you even start looking for it.
While we're on vertical storage, let's talk about component organization. The prompt mentions stocking up on screws, M2, M3, M4, and always having them on hand. That's smart, but only if you can find them when you need them.
This is where the inventory system connects. If you've got 100 little drawers of components but no labeling system, you might as well not have them.
The standard for electronics component storage is the small parts drawer cabinet. Those clear plastic drawer units with maybe 24 or 48 little drawers. They're cheap, stackable, and let you see what's inside. But the key is labeling. Label every drawer with what's in it and the key specs. Not just resistors, 10K ohm resistors, 1/4 watt, 1% tolerance. You thank yourself later.
For screws and hardware, I've seen people use those compartmented organizer boxes with adjustable dividers. One box for M2 hardware, one for M3, one for M4. Each compartment gets a specific length and head type.
Here's a tip that took me way too long to learn. Buy the hardware before you need it. The prompt mentions this. You always have everything except that one little thing. The solution is assortment kits. You can get a kit of M3 stainless steel screws, nuts, and washers in assorted lengths for maybe $15. Same for M2, M4, standoffs, heatset inserts. Spend $100 on assorted hardware kits, and you'll save yourself dozens of trips to the hardware store.
The cost isn't in the money. It's in the interruption. You're in flow. You reach for an M3 by 8mm screw. You don't have one. And now the project stops. The momentum dies. $20 of assorted hardware prevents that.
Now let's talk about the tools that actually go on the pegboard and in the drawers. And I want to be disciplined. not a list of everything you could possibly buy, but the tools with the highest ratio of usefulness to cost for someone getting started.
Start with the absolute essentials.
Number 1. A good precision screwdriver set. Not the dollar store kind with soft metal tips that deform the first time you use them. You want hardened steel bits, a rotating cap on the handle so you can apply pressure while turning, and a good range of sizes. The iFixit ProTech Toolkit is the standard recommendation for a reason. It's about $70 and includes basically every bit you'll ever need for electronics, plus tweezers, spudgers, and a suction cup. But you don't have to spend that much. A good precision driver set from Wera or Weha with a handle and maybe 20 bits will run you $30 to $40 and cover 95% of what you'll encounter.
The difference between a good driver and a bad one is safety related. A bad driver cams out of the screw head, you slip, you gouge the PCB, or stab your finger.
Number 2. Tweezers. Not cosmetic tweezers. ESD Safe Electronics tweezers with fine, precisely aligned tips. You want at least two pairs, one straight, one curved. The curved ones are for reaching into tight spots. The straight ones are for general handling. A good pair of Swiss-made tweezers? Ideal. Tech or Vitas is maybe $15 to $20 a pair and will last a lifetime if you don't use them as pry bars.
Which everyone does, and then wonders why their tweezers don't close properly.
Number 3. A multimeter. This is your diagnostic eye. You don't need a $1,000 Fluke when you're starting out. A decent auto-ranging digital multimeter from a brand like UniT or Astro AI will run you $30 to $50. You want it to measure voltage, resistance, continuity, and ideally capacitance and diode testing. The continuity buzzer is the feature you'll use most. It tells you instantly whether two points are connected.
For the kind of repair work the prompt describes, my computer won't boot, something looks broken. A multimeter is how you go from something looks wrong to this specific component has failed. Visual inspection gets you to the neighborhood. The multimeter gets you to the address.
Number 4. A soldering iron. And this is where I see beginners make the most expensive mistake. They buy a cheap fixed temperature iron for $15. Struggle with it because it's either too cold to melt solder properly or too hot and burns the flux, get frustrated, and give up. A good soldering station with adjustable temperature control is the difference between soldering being a skill you can learn and soldering being an exercise in misery.
What's the actual entry point for something usable?
The Pinecell, P-I-N-E-C-I-L-L, has completely changed the entry-level soldering market. It's about $40. It's USB. C-powered with a digital temperature display, heats up in about 6 seconds and can run off a laptop charger or a power bank. The tip is directly heated, meaning the temperature sensor is right at the tip, not somewhere up the shaft. It's portable, precise, and honestly better than soldering stations that cost 3 times as much 5 years ago.
The USB-C thing is actually huge for a small workspace. You're not dedicating a power outlet and a bulky base station. You plug it into the same charger you use for your laptop.
If you do want a traditional bench station, the KSG or T12 stations are around $60 to $80 and use the same direct heat tip technology. The important thing is temperature control and quick heat up. Cold soldering irons create bad joints. Bad joints create intermittent problems. Intermittent problems create existential despair.
Soldering iron, multimeter, tweezers, screwdrivers. That's the core four. What about the supporting cast?
Solder and flux. Lead-free solder is the environmentally responsible choice, but for learning, leaded solder is dramatically easier to work with. It melts at a lower temperature, flows better, and the joints are shinier and easier to inspect. 60-40 tin lead rosin core solder, 0.8mm diameter. 100 gram spool is maybe $10 and will last a very long time. Additional flux is not optional. The flux core in the solder wire is enough for clean new components on a fresh board. It's not enough for rework, for older boards with oxidation, or for surface mount components. A flux pin or a small tub of rosin flux makes soldering dramatically easier. It cleans the surfaces, improves wetting, and prevents bridges between pins. $5 of flux will save you hours of frustration.
I want to circle back to something the prompt mentioned that we haven't addressed yet.
Critical and often overlooked. Soldering produces rosin fumes. They're not acutely toxic in the way that burning plastic is, but they're respiratory irritants, and some people develop sensitivity over time. Long-term exposure isn't well studied, but the precautionary principle applies. You don't want to be breathing this stuff for hours.
What's the solution for a small apartment where you can't exactly install a fume hood?
A desktop fume extractor. It's a small fan with an activated carbon filter that sits on your bench, positioned maybe 6 to 8 inches from where you're soldering. It pulls fumes through the filter and exhausts clean air. A basic one is $30 to $50. The filters need replacing every 3 to 6 months depending on how much you solder. It's not an industrial solution, but for hobby level work, it's adequate. If you're working near a window, even better, you can position the extractor to blow toward the window, or get one with a duct that you can route outside. But the desktop extractor is the realistic minimum.
Let's talk about the thing that the prompt frames as the real differentiator. The difference between a stressful repair and a calm, focused one. The prompt says straightening a CPU pin is straightforward with good lighting, magnification, and the right tweezers, and almost impossible without them. But I think there's something deeper here about environment.
There absolutely is. Fine motor control is sensitive to your physiological state. If you're tense, uncomfortable, or rushing because the setup is awkward and you want it to be over, your hands shake more, your movements are jerkier. You make mistakes. A calm, orderly workspace literally improves your fine motor precision. It's not woo-woo. It's your sympathetic nervous system not being activated by environmental stressors.
The pegboard and the cable management and the good chair? They're not just about comfort or aesthetics. They're about keeping your hands steady.
There's a reason surgeons don't operate in cluttered, poorly lit rooms. It's not because they're fussy. It's because the environment directly affects manual precision.
There's a flip side to this. A well-set-up workspace makes you want to use it. If your tools are buried in a drawer and you have to clear off a bunch of stuff just to get started, the activation energy for a project is high. You put it off. The thing doesn't get fixed. A workspace that's ready to go. Soldering iron on its stand, multimeter hanging on the pegboard, mat clear, it invites you in. You see a broken thing and think, I can fix that right now, instead of, I'll deal with it eventually.
That's the soulful quality the prompt is getting at. There's a pleasure in having a space that's purpose-built for making and repairing. It's the domestic equivalent of a well-organized kitchen. When everything has its place, cooking feels like creativity. When it doesn't, cooking feels like a chore.
Let's get practical about what this all costs. If someone's starting from zero, no bench, no tools, no nothing, and they want to build a basic but good electronics workstation, what's the damage?
Let me run through it. Chair, a basic workshop stool with a foot ring, about $100. Bench surface, IKEA countertop and adjustable legs, maybe $150 total. ESD mat and wrist strap, $40. Magnifying lamp with ring light, $70. Underbench cable tray and magnetic clips, $30. Pegboard and hooks, $40. Small parts drawer cabinet, $30. Assorted hardware kits, call it $60 to cover M2, M3, M4 screws, standoffs, nuts, washers.
That's about $520 for the infrastructure, then the tools.
Precision screwdriver set, $40. ESD tweezers, 2 pairs, $30. Multimeter, $40. Soldering iron, $40 for a pine sill or $60 for a KSGER station. Solder and flux, $15. Fume extractor, $40. That's roughly another $200 to $225.
All in, around $700 to $800. That's the entry ticket to a workspace that's pleasant and capable.
Compare that to what people spend on other things. A single repair at an Apple store or a specialized electronics repair shop can easily run $200 to $300. Two or three successful repairs and the workspace has paid for itself. And that's not even counting the value of the skills you're building.
Or the value of not having that sinking feeling when something you depend on daily stops working. The prompt mentions that moment. Your computer doesn't boot and you think, there goes something I depend on for work every day. The difference between I have to find a repair shop, pay them, wait, hope they do a good job, and let me put this on the bench and figure it out. That difference is worth far more than $700.
Now, I want to address something the prompt touched on that we haven't fully unpacked. The AI-assisted repair workflow. Taking photos of circuit boards, sending them to Gemini, getting diagnostic help. This is new, and it changes the skill threshold for electronics repair.
It changes it dramatically. 5 years ago, if you had a board with a problem and you didn't know how to read schematics or identify components, you were stuck. You'd post photos on a forum and hope someone knowledgeable replied. Now you can take a photo, describe the symptoms, and get an analysis in seconds. The AI can identify components, suggest test points, walk you through diagnostic steps.
With the crucial caveat that the AI isn't actually an expert. It's a pattern matcher trained on a vast corpus of electronics knowledge. It can be wrong. It can miss things. But as a first-pass diagnostic tool, it's remarkably capable. It lowers the barrier from, you need to know electronics, to, you need to know enough to follow instructions and verify results.
Which is a much lower bar, and it makes the whole endeavor feel less intimidating. You're not alone at the bench. You've got a consult available.
This connects back to the workspace setup. If you're going to be using AI assistants, taking photos, sharing video, following step-by-step guidance, you need your workspace to support that. You need a place to prop up your phone or tablet where it can see the board. You need good lighting so the camera can capture clear images. You need the bench clear enough that you're not knocking things over while following instructions on a screen.
The AI-assisted workflow and the organized workspace are mutually reinforcing. The better your setup, the more effectively you can use the AI. The more effectively you use the AI, the more repairs you can tackle, and the more value you get from the workspace.
It's a virtuous cycle. And I think that's the broader point. We're not just talking about buying stuff. We're talking about building a capability, the ability to diagnose and fix the electronic things in your life. That capability has a setup cost, the workspace and the tools. But once you've made that investment, it keeps paying dividends.
There's a mindset shift that comes with it. You stop seeing electronic devices as black boxes that either work or don't. You start seeing them as assemblies of components, any of which can be tested, removed, and replaced. That's empowering in a way that's hard to describe until you've experienced it.
The first time you take something that was completely dead and bring it back to life with your own hands and your own tools, it's a genuine thrill. It never really gets old.
Let's talk about one more thing before we wrap. The prompt mentions engraving, and you've mentioned it before in the context of inventory systems. What's the use case at the workbench?
Labeling things permanently. A rotary engraver, a small handheld tool with a diamond or carbide tip, lets you etch labels into metal, plastic, wood. For a workbench, the main use is labeling storage, those small parts drawers we talked about. You can write on them with a marker, but marker rubs off. An engraved label is permanent. Same for tool handles. If you've got multiple pairs of tweezers that look similar, a tiny engraved mark tells you which is which.
It's the, I will never have to relabel this solution.
For a more sophisticated setup, a label maker that prints durable adhesive labels is faster and more readable. The Brother P Touch series is the standard. The labels are laminated and resist solvents and abrasion. A basic model is about $30. The label tape is the ongoing cost, but a single cartridge lasts a long time.
Between the engraver for permanent marks and a label maker for drawer fronts and cable tags, you've got an organization system that actually stays organized.
That's the thing that separates a workspace that looks good on day one from a workspace that still looks good a year later. Systems that are easy to maintain get maintained. Systems that require constant effort get abandoned.
Which brings us back to the core principle. Design the workspace so that putting things away is easier than leaving them out. The pegboard is easier than a drawer. The magnetic cable clip is easier than tossing the cable on the bench. The labeled drawer is easier than rummaging through a pile. When the path of least resistance is also the organized path, the workspace stays organized without willpower.
That's the whole philosophy in one sentence. Make the right thing the easy thing. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, fishermen on Lake Baikal preserved their catch using a technique they called stone icing, which involved packing fish in snow mixed with crushed limestone, a method later misattributed to Siberian shamans until Russian naturalist Johann Georg Gamelin documented in 1735 that it was actually adapted from Chinese salt-curing practices brought north by tea caravans.
Right. To close, the question the prompt is really asking, I think, is whether the joy and focus that comes from a well-set-up workspace is accessible to someone in a small apartment with a limited budget. And the answer is, yes, absolutely. It's not about square footage. It's about intentionality. Chair first, then surface, then light, then organization. The tools come after the foundation.
The foundation costs less than people think. $700 to $800 gets you into a workspace that would have been the envy of a professional repair shop 30 years ago. The tools are better, cheaper, and more accessible than they've ever been. And with AI-assisted diagnostics, the knowledge barrier is lower than ever. There's never been a better time to start fixing things yourself.
The prompt also gets at something I think is underappreciated, the emotional difference between, I hope I can fix this, and I have a place where I fix things. The workspace isn't just tools and surfaces. It's a statement to yourself about what you're capable of.
And on that note, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you've built a workspace you're proud of, or if you're just getting started and have questions, leave us a review wherever you listen. We read them all. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.